I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Do red wines give you a headache? Well, if you think it's sulfites, you might want to think again. I'll bust that myth and also give you a plan for avoiding the red wine headache. I really know you like to eat fish, but have you ever thought of catching your own? Chef Michael Chimarusti has some fish stories for us. Jonathan Gold is here. Plus, I've got a chance for you to support the show and win a new Japanese chef knife. But as always, let's get to the area farmers markets and see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We have caught up with Nancy Zaslavsky, who is a frequent market shopper when she's not down in Mexico leading her cook's tours. Nancy is also the author of a cookbook called A Cook's Tour of Mexico. She specializes in finding the most interesting ethnic dishes south of the border. And Nancy, you're here today. You've got a list, you've got a cart, and you've been up shopping up at the greens stand, buying some greens. What are you getting?
Sure. I've been up at Bill Coleman's, my favorite spot in the market, especially in the summertime, because he has the most fabulous herbs from southern Mexico. That's where I get the Oaxacan green amaranth. I also picked up some purslane, and I cooked that up with some white onions and chilies and a little cilantro. Real simple, real super healthy. I also noticed that he has an incredible abundance of epazote, almost as much as in my backyard. It spreads like wildflower when it likes the place it's in, but his looks really thick and wonderful and healthy if you're thinking of ever cooking a pot of black beans. That's the herb of choice to put in those beans.
Now, let me ask you real quick. Do you put the epazote in toward the end or at the beginning when you start?
What I do is put some in the beginning with the stems, and then at the end, rip off the leaves and throw that in. So it has a little bit of both. I cook it with, again, white onion and epazote and nothing else, and salt at the end. Mm-hmm. He also has a Thai basil. Now, we call this Oaxacan basil in southern Mexico. It's the same thing. It's purple basil. Oaxacans use it to smell their home. They don't cook with it. Where Thai people cook beef with it and makes a very famous Thai beef dish, and you have to use the purple basil.
And Nancy, describe the difference of the flavor. How is Thai basil different from your nice, soft, green Italian basil?
Italian basil is a lot more flavorful. Oh. And it's the perfect combination with gorgeous heirloom tomatoes in the summertime.
So the Thai basil, it's just more, it's intense.
It's almost called cinnamon basil, yeah. And it has a little bit of that type of flavor in it. I mean, for me, to smell my house, I buy it, and to cook with tomatoes, I go for the Italian.
Do you stick it in a jar with water?
Yes. Like a bouquet of flowers.
Like a bouquet of roses. Yeah. Guess who's here? Evan Kleiman here at the market shopping. And Evan, you're on the prowl for good stuff. We're right
across
the
street. Yeah, this is like such a treat for me, because usually on Wednesday mornings I'm at the studio recording the show, doing lots of interviews. But today I got a reprieve. I don't have to go till the afternoon. So what did I want to do? Come down here. And I heard you guys talking about cinnamon basil. I was just at a friend's house last weekend, and I had cinnamon basil ice cream, which was one of the most unbelievable things I've ever tasted, and I believe the recipe was from the Chez Panisse dessert cookbook. But I also heard you, Nancy, talking about purslane, and you cook with it. I've never cooked with it. Whenever I see that Coleman has it, I always love to make a fattoush, which is that Arab salad with arugula, purslane, chopped peppers, tomatoes, and pita chips. Pita bread chips with a nice lemony dressing, and it's so much fun to eat purslane raw because it reminds you of when you were a little kid and you'd like suck on sourgrass.
The thing is, you have to cook purslane lightly. You don't cook it for 20 minutes. You just cook it for 5 minutes, not even that. You want to basically blanch it in a saute pan after your white onions and your garlic are already cooked.
And a little hot pepper.
Yeah, and hot chilies, and you're set to go.
And I heard purslane is the one that has beneficial omegas, and that
very rare in a vegetable.
Very rare. Okay.
One of the things that I'm really excited to start making is, years ago, I did a salad called Two Reds, which is beets and tomatoes. Beautiful. It's so incredible because the deep deep red of the beets, particularly if you roast them first, which is what I like to do instead of boiling them, mixed with that different color red of the tomato, it becomes this amazing tint. And so this year I'm going to do that same thing with heirlooms. I'm going to add a third red. I'm going to add a little bit of raw onion. And I'm going to do, you know, olive oil, salt, but a little bit of cumin and a little bit of pomegranate molasses as my acid.
All right, Evan.
I'll fight you for the tomatoes. Bye.
All right, that was Evan Kleiman, and that was Nancy Zaslavsky, and they are chefs, and they're on a mission, and they're out of here. So it was really fun to catch up with both of them and hear what they're shopping for, and as always, get great new ideas for what to cook. Other new items at the market that have really been catching my eye this week are the long beans. These are Chinese long beans, and they come from Briar Patch Farm. Vilma Causey is a grower that comes down from Kingsburg. These are the beans that are about a foot to a foot and a half long. She's got them in the red variety and the green variety. They're a wonderful, kind of a nutty-flavored, stringless long green bean. Most people will chop them up into 1 or 2 inch lengths, lightly braise them or parboil them or steam them, and then use them in wonderful, like a Chinese, any kind of an Asian-flavored salad. They're wonderful beans for eating hot or cold. We also have some delicious Italian white, like a cannelloni bean, only bigger. And these are still in the pods. The pods are just now starting to dry, so the beans are super fresh. These come from Two Peas in a Pod, from Richard Sager out of Arroyo Grande. And they're a beautiful white, creamy bean. You can easily pop out of the shell and then lightly boil or use in soups or pastas or as a side dish with onions and garlic. Really nice bean. Be sure to join your friends at the Farmers Market next Thursday at the Santa Monica Main Library at 6th and Santa Monica Boulevard. We're going to be holding our second Farmers Market panel, which consists of two farmers. This week we're going to have two chefs. We're going to have Suzanne Goyne from Luke and AOC. And we're also going to have Amelia Saltzman, who's a home cook, combining their thoughts with two of our farmers at the market about how to find the best ingredients to cook either for yourself or for your restaurant. The panel is going to be moderated by Evan Kleiman, and after the panel at 8:30, we are going to have food that's going to be prepared and brought to us by Suzanne Goyne. The admission is free. It's at the Santa Monica Library. For sign-ups, you can go to smplsantamonicapubliclibrary.org. This week, we also start our KCRW semi-annual pledge drive, where we come and ask listeners to become sponsors, donors, supporters of the station. And it's an easy, simple thing to do, to pick up the phone, pledge your support, and guarantee that you're going to be hearing the sights, sounds, and hopefully someday the smells of the farmers market when we get sense around here on the radio. All the great things that the market brings to you every single week. I know the farmers appreciate the support and the exposure they get on the radio. So I hope you're all going to take a minute right when the show is over, or even during the show, to pick up the phone, talk to one of the friendly volunteers, pledge. Even at a minimal level, you can pledge your support, and then you can feel like a real member of this fantastic radio family. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Robert Rajness of Wine Expo is my favorite kind of egghead. Lots of brains, lots of knowledge scattered deeply all over the place. Lots of delicious connections. This morning, we're talking about the myth of red wine headaches. Okay, so what is the deal? It's a myth?
There are many people who do, in fact, get headaches from consuming red wine. But it is not that all red wines will give you headaches. It's that the great majority of wines that the average person is given, which means big, extracted, barrel-fermented, highly colored, highly tannic, Cabernets and Syrahs from California and Australia, and certain examples of the same sort of thing made in Italy, France, and Spain, those are the problem.
Why are they the problem?
A lot of people think that the problem is sulfites. They think this because it says contains sulfites on the label. Has nothing to do with that. The only scientifically recognized reaction to sulfur dioxide is asthmatics get asthma attacks. What it is histamines. This is well documented. I've worked on this a lot to write a funny therapy piece about this with a couple of allergist customers of ours. Histamines come from the pigments and in red grapes, from the skins and the stems, and also from barrels. So even white wines, very big, heavily barrel-fermented white wines can have histamines. And often the people who are going to have problem with histamines in wine will also get the same sort of reaction from overbrewed tea, dark chocolate, and a few other things that contain histamines.
So it's sort of like the same things that are loaded with the antioxidants and are supposed to be really good for you, in some people will produce an allergic reaction.
In extreme dosages, but also there are many ways that you can moderate the intake of these things, and that's what we're going to talk about today, how you can drink some red wines, drink a fair amount of red wine, but there are certain behavioral things that you have to do to cut down on the reaction.
Okay, before we get into that, I want to just make sure that I'm understanding you, that some people will say, oh, well, I was given a cheap red wine and I got a headache from it, like rot gut headache.
Right. Yeah.
And in fact, the wines you're talking about are the opposite. They're
absolutely
the high end.
Yeah. The problem with inexpensive wines and headaches is usually that they're very light and drinkable and people drink too much of them. What we're really talking about is when you pay more money for wine, you usually get more extract, which means dry solids out of the grapes, of anything other than water, and more time in wood, in barrels, and extract from the barrels. And those are the things that set you off. And absolutely, the more money you pay, you know, we get people come in the store, they say, oh, no, I need like a $100 wine. That won't give me a headache. Most $100 wines are going to blow your head off.
Love that. Okay, so how can we moderate our behavior? A terrible thing to tell people who really love wine that they have to moderate their behavior.
Well, it's really not even so much moderating as organizing. First and foremost, never drink on an empty stomach. This seems like a normal thing for Europeans, but Americans have this problem because everybody's on a diet and nobody wants to have an appetizer and they don't want to have snacks in the afternoon, etc. If you're going to have a glass of wine, whether it's red or white or bubbles or Campari or whatever, have something with it. And it really helps if it has two components to it, starch and oil, which could be some really good bread from La Brea Bakery and some extra virgin olive oil, or it could be McDonald's French fries. It really doesn't matter.
The things people run screaming away from
exactly.
In our part of the world.
Yeah, but the starch absorbs the material in your stomach. The oil coats your stomach lining walls just like the pink stuff in the Pepto-Bismol commercial. It really helps. Second thing, always, always drink 8 ounces of water before every 4 ounces of wine. 12 ounces of beer or a shot of whiskey or whatever spirit you may, because the things that are causing you problems are water-soluble, and this helps immensely.
So I've always noticed when I'm in Italy that Italians naturally do that.
Yes.
As they're drinking through the courses, they're also hitting that bottle of water.
Right, and the people who are serving you assume that, and you know they're putting a liter of water on the table every 45 minutes for every two people, no matter what. And you know, another thing, people come back from Europe and think, oh, the wines must be different there. I didn't get headaches there. Well, when you were there, you weren't working. You might have been on your honeymoon. You were eating really good food. You were drinking lots of water. Now you're here. You're working like a dog. You're not on your honeymoon. You're eating junk food at your desk at work, etc. And then you're having a glass of 15% alcohol Chardonnay that was fermented in new wood as a cocktail when you get home. It's behavioral. We have a doctor customer who, whenever he hears someone say, you know, tequila gives me a hangover, wine gives me a headache, says, no, product does not cause these problems, behavior does.
That's really nice to know. It's nice to know there's a reason for us to consume, a balance of things.
Oh, absolutely. And then the third part of this equation is the wines that you want to drink. Any white wine that proudly says on the label that it was fermented in new French oak and when you open the bottle it smells like vanilla extract, that's probably going to give you a problem. Any red wine that you put 2 ounces in a glass and you hold it up to a piece of paper or to the light and you can't see through it, it's probably going to give you a problem. If it also says on the back label, oh, it was aged for 2 years in new French oak and it smells like vanilla compote with raspberry in it, it's going to give you a problem. But that is really a relatively small proportion of the red wines out there. There's a tremendous amount of red wines from the lighter end of the Chianti spectrum, Beaujolais, Bartolino, nice wines from southern Italy like Salice Salentino, lots of things from southern France and Spain, also even in California, things from Gamay, things for the lighter end of the Syrah spectrum. And often, again, it's going to be things that are less money, you know, $8 to $15. You're spending more than $20, you're very likely going to have a problem, unless it's a nice Burgundy, which is always expensive.
Now, do you have this kind of knowledge about indigestion in wine?
That's a separate issue involving acid and acid reflux. And when we say indigestion, do we mean heartburn? Do we mean acid reflux? Do we mean I just not digesting my food? This is a whole much more complicated equation and probably involves inputs from the pharmaceutical industry. We were talking about Pepsi AC earlier and, you know, I've got ideas about it, but I don't want to say I'm qualified to talk about it.
Well, thank you for all those things that you were qualified to talk about.
Well, thank you. It's always fun to talk with you.
I've been talking with Robert Rajness of Wine Expo, which is located at 2933 Santa Monica Boulevard in Santa Monica. We've been talking about certain ways to get around the red wine headache. I'm a voracious reader, so I was just so happy to find the Life magazine summer reading issue on my living room floor. All the stories were fishing stories, and I found myself thinking about childhood fishing trips, fishing spots, and cooking freshly caught fish over an open fire. And then I thought, I really want to talk to Michael Chimarusti about all this fishing stuff. Michael is a major wizard in the kitchen, and his particular skill and passion centers around fish at his restaurant Providence on Melrose. But he's also a fisherman, and I'd like to hear some of his fish stories. So you look pretty sun-kissed. Were you out there recently?
As a matter of fact, I just got back from Oahu, a week in Oahu. And one day we did spend fishing, of course, because I can't ever be that close to water without wetting a line. So we went out in search of blue marlin, but didn't catch any and had to settle for skipjack tuna and wahoo, which the Hawaiians call ono. You know, it's a beautiful fish.
So when you're sea fishing like that, what is the size of most of the fish that you managed to get on board?
Well, the prize of the day was the ono, which was it was about 35 pounds, which really by ono standards, that's not a big one. A big one is, 150 or 160. And they're a blazing fish. They're known to be one of the fastest swimmers in the sea. And so their trademark is sort of they hit your lure going about 40, and then they speed up to about 50 and running in the opposite direction, and you just have to try and keep up with them.
And when you fish like that, when you're far from home, what do you do with the fish that you catch?
Well, that day, the skipjack tuna, the mate on board, he at one point he came down out of the crow's nest and asked me if I liked raw fish, and I said, yeah, every once in a while I'll eat a little. And so
he had no idea.
Yeah. So he filleted one up and, you just happened to have a little aloha soy sauce, which is, I guess, a local Hawaiian soy. And he put in a little bowl for me and a few pieces of fish and doused it with a little soy. And I took the liberty of just throwing a couple of ice cubes in there. It serves two purposes. It dilutes the soy a little bit and it cools the fish down to a really nice ice cold bracing temperature. And then the ono we cooked at home later that night.
What did you do with it?
I just simply grilled it. It was so perfect. I mean, we were talking maybe 6 hours after it was pulled out of the water. And ono is a delicious, white fleshed, firm fish. Not unlike tuna in terms of texture.
Did your passion with fish start out with the fish and then you started fishing? Or did it start out fishing and then you ended up falling in love with fish and just learning everything you could about it?
A little of both. I mean, at one point, if you'd asked me when I was a kid, I would have told you I was going to be a marine biologist. But fishing was always part of the game. You know, when I was a kid, one of my first memories was on Armistice Boulevard in Providence, Rhode Island, my grandfather handing me my first fishing rod, when I was a little kid. And, he used to take me out fishing all the time in Rhode Island, both on the ocean and in some of the small parks, freshwater fishing. And then my dad and I, we would spend, at least 10 days a year in Princeton, Maine, which is a little town on the St. Croix River flowage, fishing for smallmouth bass and pickerel, which was just idyllic and beautiful and, just couldn't be better. We would wake up, we'd have a little breakfast at 4 o'clock in the morning, go out on the boat, catch a bunch of fish, bring them home, have, beer-battered fish for lunch, and then go out and fish again when the sun kind of cooled a little bit, and then have beer-battered fish for dinner. And that was it, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey, but I grew up on a dirt road, which most people don't believe, and we had a beautiful little watershed up the street from our house. And I spent, I would get home from school and pick up my fishing rod and walk up the street a quarter mile and fish pretty much every day.
You were like Opie.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. I mean, it just beautiful, and since I've moved here to California, the saltwater fishing here is unbelievable for a, big urban center. You can light off on a boat from San Pedro Harbor or from Long Beach Harbor and be fishing just absolutely beautiful waters chock full of fish if you know what you're doing.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, from San Pedro, it's 26 miles, I believe, or 22 miles to Catalina Island. And, there are bruisers out there, yellowtail that'll go up to 40 pounds. There are still billfish out there, swordfish and marlin that are caught on the backside of Catalina all the time. Beautiful local halibut, white sea bass, which are just one of the real treasures of the Southern California coast. I don't keep that much fish when I fish locally. I prefer to throw it back. But every once in a while, if you catch a really nice trophy fish, it's a wonderful thing, sort of bring home and grill.
So when you fish, you tend to go sea fishing more than freshwater fishing.
Yeah. The fishing at times can be, and right now it happens to be quite good. I check the fish reports every morning when I get to work, sportfishingreport.com, and see who's catching what and where.
So when you go out, are you going out with a lot of other fishermen, or do you charter a boat just for yourself and
some
friends?
No, I go on a party boat. I'm the guy that's there at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I get a good spot on the boat and, take a nap when the boat's heading over to Catalina Island and then fish all day.
Is it a good way for beginners to start?
I think so. Yeah, because, I mean, there are people there on the boat, the captain and the mates, and that they'll help you along. You know, you can rent the gear right there at the harbor most days. And, you know, you buy a day license. If you're not an avid fisherman, you don't get out a lot. And for very little money, you know, you can have a great day on the water and maybe bring home something to eat.
When you were growing up, was your childhood peppered with fishing stories?
Yeah, the best one was my grandfather. They lived in Providence, Rhode Island, worked in Providence, Rhode Island, but they had a little shack on the beach in Narragansett. And when I say shack on the beach, I really do mean a shack on the beach. And as a matter of fact, I think in the hurricane of 53, they had a shack that was very close to the water that was actually picked up in the hurricane and moved about a half mile back on the water. And they found it, and that was where it was. They put a foundation under it, and that's where their shack was from that point on. But he had a little boat, which was it was called a Water Witch. But he actually called it the Water, and he changed the W for a B. That became the nickname of the boat. But anyway, I mean, he would always be out gigging for flounder, which is where you go in the sandy flats at night with a light on your head, and you sort of look for the outline of flounder as they lay in their, you know, in the sand. And you have a gig or a spear, and when you go over them, you just kind of, you know, stick them like that. The story that I remember the most was the biggest striper he ever caught off the coast of Rhode Island, he actually caught with his hands because he was fishing off the rocks, which is what you need to do if you're going to fish for striper, and casting out, and looked down and he saw a tide pool that had trapped a big striper. The tide went out and the striper got caught, and he just couldn't escape anymore. So he's swimming around, like circling in this tide pool, and my grandfather's standing there with a fishing rod in his hand hoping for a bite, and he said, you know, forget this. He put his fishing rod down and jumped in the tide pool with the bass and wrestled it with his bare hands and brought it out. And it was about a 40-pound striper, which is very large for a striped bass.
So do you have a series of really easy, either raw or cooked sauces that you use to accompany the grilled fish that you make once you get your catch home?
I mean, a great thing to do, I think, just warm a little bit of soy sauce, a little bit of water, taste the two things together until they're palatable and not too salty. Squeeze a little bit of lime juice in there and a little bit of butter, just a little, or olive oil if you prefer, and warm that over the stove. When you pull the fish off the grill, just put that on the fish, and I think that's enough. Especially, you know, a fish you catch with your own hands, pull out of the water by yourself, it always tastes a lot better, and I think you want to enjoy it in the most simple way you possibly can.
I'm already hungry. Thank you so much,
Thank
Michael.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Michael Cimarusti. He's the chef and owner of Providence, which is on Melrose near Wilcox. He's really an incredible fisherman and fish chef. Once again, it's that part of the show where we get our hit of instant gratification. You get to hear Jonathan Gold talk about a wonderful dish, and you can get in your car and go there right now. Jonathan, of course, is our intrepid food explorer that we most often read in the LA Weekly, his counterintelligence columns. Where are we going today?
We are going to East Hollywood, to the heart of the L. Ron Hubbard district.
And what are we going to eat there?
We are going to a wonderful breakfast restaurant called Square One.
Square One. So is this primarily a breakfast place?
It's primarily breakfast. They have good sandwiches at lunch. The thing that I admire about this place is they try to raise breakfast to a different level, not by doing incredibly complicated preparations, but by using the sort of ingredients that we all aspire to use.
So give us an idea. Where are their eggs from?
Mike and Sons.
Oh, I like Mike and Sons from the Wednesday market.
Exactly. And their berries are from Harry's Berries. And their bacon and ham are Nooskies. And their grits are from Ants and Mills in North Carolina.
It's like the greatest hits of breakfast ingredients.
Exactly so. They take a lot of care with it, which is nice. Their pancakes are of the thick, fluffy school.
Not my favorite, but that's just one person's opinion.
I sort of like the crepey school a little better. But one of them, for example, is served with a caramel that they use bacon in.
That sounds incredible.
Can you imagine like using bacon fat and butter making your caramel?
Oh my, that sounds really good. Oh, yum.
They do a decent French toast with, you know, using brioche. They do the aforementioned grits, which are done properly. They're cooked for a really long time, which you have to do with stone ground grits. And you can either have them plain or, more likely, flavored with tiny little cubes of bacon that, like, just pop in your mouth. It's a delightful thing. The bacon itself, if you order a side of bacon, it comes out less like bacon than it does, because I assume they cook it very long and very slowly, like one of those wonderful pork belly preps at a Chinese restaurant. In other words, it's not crisp, but it's not flaccid. It's just juicy. It's all juice. It collapses in your mouth.
You are such a pork hound.
If it comes from a pig, I'm happy about it. It must be my Jewish upbringing.
What about omelets?
The omelets are quite good. I had one the other morning with chorizo and hot peppers in it. It's not of the big fluffy school. It's more of the delicious mat of egg school.
And what is the price point of breakfast at Square One?
It usually ends up being about $8, $9 a person with coffee. You can do more than that. You can get a lot of side dishes. But really, like an omelet and like those nice fried potatoes and some grits, what more could you want than
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Except for like maybe a side of pancake with that incredible caramel bacon syrup.
That's true. I wonder if they do that on ice cream. That'd be so
that would be so good. Now, as I recall, this place is rather small.
It's in a place that you may remember as New York George's from the 80s. There's a little bit of room inside, but there's also a really big patio for when it's not 105 degrees out.
That's terrific. So thank you so much for taking us out for breakfast. Give us once again all the details we need to get there.
The restaurant's called Square One, and it's at 4854 Fountain in Hollywood.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, one of our favorite food guides for locally sourced delicious meals, talking to us about a breakfast find. You can read Jonathan every week in the LA Weekly, his counterintelligence columns.